This is CBC Radio 1, 91.5 FM in Ottawa. Canada lives here.
I'm Christiane Conlon. Welcome to Fear Itself. When my son's beloved bus driver died of a heart attack on his way to work this winter, both my son and I cried at the news. Bob was 53 years old and a bigger-than-life personality. He was friendly and hilarious. He couldn't possibly be dead. He would pull up the next morning, or perhaps his ghost would be there in the driver's seat. He just couldn't be completely dead. La, 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 la. This is Fear Itself on CBC Radio 1.
It does seem rather upsetting and grisly, and researching hangings left me in a dark place as well.
Screaming at the sky, I was swearing, I was crying the whole time. Like, hearing it said so matter-of-factly was terrifying, I think.
I believe that most people die in our culture absolutely riven by the terror that everyone around them is going to be able to proceed in the days, weeks, months, or perhaps years after they die, as if they'd never been.
Fear Itself. This week on the program, we explore the fear of death. I've always been obsessed with death, and I explore it in my writing. Whether it's the mythos of immortality of death, or violent and untimely death, or the end of a long and well-lived life. But you see, the thing is, it's never me who is dying. It's fictional characters. They die for me. It's the safe and easy way to explore death. I don't have to risk anything. There's nothing easy about being hanged to death. And up until 1976, when Canada abolished the death penalty, that was the only method of execution, hanging. The British set up shop in Halifax in 1749, and it was an incredibly violent place where hangings were used as a punishment, and also, it seems to me, became a gruesome form of entertainment. The hangings were public. You could go and you could watch people die. Author Deanna Foster finds Nova Scotia's dark past compelling, and she wrote about it in her book, A History of Hangings in Nova Scotia. Were public hangings intended to scare people?
Yes, they were. They had a few purposes. One was to show justice done to the person who had committed a crime, and the other was to deter people from committing that crime as well. Unfortunately, they didn't work as a deterrent because crimes were still committed, and in the early days of Nova Scotia, theft was enough to get someone hanged, to later on when it was mostly murders that were resulting in the deaths of people being hanged.
How did people react to public hangings?
The emotions that the person who was being hanged portrayed really affected the mob that was there. If the person was carefree and boisterous at the time of their death, people saw this as almost heroic and they rallied behind them. If the people were contrite and looking very upset and looking very repentant, like with the Saladin pirates, then people said, oh, this is very sad that these young boys who are no more than 23 years old are being executed. We feel bad for them.
So Halifax was a major naval center back in the day. So could you tell me a little bit about gibbeting and what that is and how it was used to create fear?
Gibbeting was normally done with pirates, and because we were such a popular naval community, we had so many pirates here. They're a big part of our history. They were nasty people. They murdered whole ships full of people, even children. And so as a way of deterring people from piracy, they put them in gibbets, which was a cage. And you put the body in the cage and you cover it with tar to make sure that the birds didn't pick the body apart too quickly. because you wanted to last for a little while to show as a warning. They were put out on McNabb's Island, so any ships coming into the harbor would see them hanging there. One summer they moved them to George's Island, closer to the harbor, but it was in the summer and people complained about the smell. So they had to send them back out to McNabb's Island in their cages. It does seem rather upsetting and grisly, and researching hangings left me almost quite in a dark place as well. And I've had people ask me, did you watch the hanging of Saddam Hussein? Because that was on YouTube and everywhere you could find the video of it. And no, I never have, and I never want to watch a hanging because I know that it's a horrific way to go, and it's a terrible thing to do to someone as a way of execution.
Can you talk a little bit about where we're standing right now?
Sure. We're at Griffin's Pond, and it's called that because a person, Lawrence Griffin, was wrongfully hanged in 1821. And even though witnesses came forward with the person who was supposed to have committed the murder, Lawrence was still the one who was hanged for it. And the city named the pond after him as sort of an apology.
I can't help but look at this pond now here in the public gardens. I didn't know its name. I can't believe that, and like the legacy. And I don't think I'll ever look at this pond the same way again. After speaking with Deanna about the violent and gruesome past of Halifax, it shocks me how easily all those lives just fade into time. A man's entire legacy is nothing more than a name of a pond most people don't even know about. And yet this happens to all of us. None of us live forever. And the memory of us will gradually fade away. And we'll just be a name on a tombstone. And if we're lucky, someone might wonder someday who we were. You're listening to Fear Itself. I'm Christiane Conlon. Just 2 weeks after my son's bus driver, Bob, died, I had a mammogram. It was abnormal. I could handle the first abnormal test. It was probably nothing. But the news of the second abnormal test had me sobbing on the sidewalk. I told a friend about it, and I fell apart. I couldn't walk. I just stood there. It wasn't just the fear of dying too soon. Now it was the fear of dying before my child. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do anything. I just kept thinking I was going to die. A frantic dread underlined everything I did in those next few weeks. Every trivial moment seemed magnificent. I remember drinking cold coffee and thinking it was the best coffee I'd ever had in my life. And it was cold and damp outside, and I remember thinking if I could have stale cold coffee and be in a cold winter day for the rest of my life, I would be happy. Terror breathes a vigorous life into all those old cliches, into those everyday things. During the core biopsy, I could see my son's face in my mind's eye. I could smell his soft hair. I trembled at the thought I might not see him grow up, that I had birthed him, now to abandon him. But I was lucky. It wasn't anything. It was benign. I didn't have breast cancer. But after that, I did have this horrible mantra in my head. You can die at any time. Death does not discriminate. And death often does not announce itself. It just grabs you, and then it's over. 37-year-old Terry DeSilva knows that better than anyone. She lives in Dayton, Ohio, with her husband and her 2-year-old daughter. And Terry has stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. She lives daily with the fear of death, with the fear of dying young.
When we were sitting in the surgeon's office getting the results of the biopsy, I remember shaking. I've noticed that's my thing lately. Every time I'm getting bad news about the breast cancer or I'm sitting in an office getting test results, I'm like, my body is shaking, physically shaking. I can feel it in the pit of my stomach. And that was on that drive home. And when we got home, my husband and I were just, you know, you think the worst, okay. Even though at that point it was only stage 2, fast forward to my consult, and then it was conferring about my new stage 4 diagnosis, and that doctor said to me, okay, well, you'll have a couple of months to a couple of years. So he actually put it out there on the table like that. And the whole ride home from Columbus, that's when I had my breakdown. Screaming at the sky, I was swearing, I was crying the whole time, like hysterically sobbing, just really hearing it said so matter-of-factly was terrifying, I think.
You have a 2-year-old daughter.
Yes.
So what's your fear like as a parent?
That's, of course, one of the biggest fears, because I think, oh, Lord, she's only 2. She'll be 3 at the end of this month. And you think, okay, if I can make it 10 years, let's see, she'll be 12 then. No, I can't go then, because then she hasn't gotten into the teenage puberty year. She needs me for those. I'm like, okay, I'll try it. You know, I got to live for 20 years. At least then she'll be off on her own in college. You know, 5 years, that's not an option. 2 years is not an option. I can't leave her. I can't leave my husband. I can't leave her without her mom. I mean, I just lost my own mom, as a lot of people know, to cancer 2 years ago. And even at 36, fully grown, this was one of the most difficult experiences of my life. So I don't want to put my daughter through the same thing. I can relate to what that journey looks like and what the end may look like. And I think it's not just fear of death that's terrifying, but also the fear of getting really sick, as I saw my mom get really sick towards the end.
When you feel that, do you find that the fears affect your behavior?
Yes. There's some days, just recently, Catherine Russell Rich, she was one of my idealized women who had lived for 20 years with stage 4 breast cancer, and she just recently passed away, and she I had been holding her up as my icon, my if she can do it, I can do it. And then she died, and I said, oh no, what does that mean for me? And I remember for a while, a day, 2 days, 3 days, I was in a real funk. I was sad, and that surprised me, because I didn't even really know this woman. Depressed, getting into that yucky place that, oh, life just is kind of sucky. And then it's really a delicate balance to not get stuck in that place and just stay there and think, well, screw it. Everyone with stage 4 breast cancer is going to die anyway, so I might as well just figure that's my fate.
Do you believe that everyone with stage 4 breast cancer will die?
No, because I've also read that there are the 1-2% that are the miracle folks that actually get through this and have no evidence of disease long term. They never use the word cured, so to speak, but these would be the folks that are as close to that as possible. So I believe that I can be that 1-2%. And in my gut, in my heart of hearts, from the beginning, there's been a piece of me that's always felt that this would not get me. So when the fear comes at me, I try and go back to that place.
So does the fear play a positive role for you then?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but because I do generally channel nervous energy into a good thing, and find the positive in it. But the fear, I don't know, the fear of death, when I'm in the fear, it sure doesn't feel very positive.
What's scary for you?
Being gone, leaving this body, this world, these circumstances right now. I'm not ready to leave. I'm only 37. I've got a daughter. I still have so many things left I want to do. The death itself isn't necessarily the scary part. It's the leaving this world right now that's really scary. It feels like my body gets jacked up on adrenaline too. My heartbeat goes a lot faster. Sometimes the breathing is a bit more shallow and difficult. I guess that sounds a bit like a panic attack. But luckily it doesn't stay for too long. And it's a mixed bag between the panic attack feelings and the depression, just sit on the couch and don't even want to get up and deal with the day feelings.
So how do you cope with the fear of dying and stay engaged in your life?
Cry when I need to cry. I mean, as a therapist myself, what I always would tell my clients is, you know, you need to feel the feelings without getting trapped in them. So that's what I'm attempting to do. It's been a lot of crying, but I try not to stay stuck there. I think what allows me to keep going is really just staying focused in the moment. It's so cliched. I grew up Buddhist and it's so just cliche Buddhism, stay in the moment. All you have is the present moment. But that's become my new reality. So I really have to just enjoy the moments that I'm in. And doing so, I'm able to find a lot of moments of joy. It's odd to me how living with this, I'm still able to really enjoy life.
Terry's strength and courage is remarkable to me. Death isn't an abstraction for Terry, but nor does the fear of dying completely consume her. She takes that fear in hand. These days, I think it's only the visceral fright of death. It takes that big scare to force some of us into truly inhabiting our lives. Stephen Jenkinson has witnessed that visceral fright over and over again. He has visited the deathbeds of over 1,000 people. He was the leader of a palliative care counseling team at Toronto's Mount Sinai Hospital, and Stephen was also the focus of the documentary Grief Walker. Why are we so terrified of death in our culture?
Well, the obvious reason is you don't get to see much of it. So it's a hidden thing, and it's proof positive that the culture that gave me my life is probably irredeemably a death-phobic one. So where would you be likely to find the death phobia showing up? Well, surely the deathbeds are one such place, but it's the fence that's put around the deathbed that's really the more ample evidence that families close ranks and you have to sort of know the secret password to get inside. So how can you be possibly, I'm going to use the expression, good at it? And then by the time your turn comes, I mean, how many have you been to? What do you know about it? What do you know about what it asks of you? Nothing. You just know what it does to you instead. That's the basic death phobia in action. So if you come to your own death as a rank amateur, and then the whisper campaign keeps you away from everyone else's death during the course of your life, you don't have a chance to feel any other way about death, have any other estimation about it. And fear begins to look like intelligence then. So my job for years was to try to sell good death to people for whom the only kind of good death was the one you never saw coming.
Can you define good death?
Yeah, it's the one you see coming. Meaning, when you know that dying is on your horizon, it gives you a chance for the first time to love something as if it's not going to last. It's the most counterintuitive venture you can undertake in our culture, is to decide to love the world anyway, when you know you're not going to last a long time in it. This kind of love that I'm talking about is a kind of moral intelligence that's willing to know the way things are. Another word for that would be grief. Grief is the perfect, almost the divinely wrought antidote to fear. Fear, the way I've come to contend with it over the years, not so much personally, but certainly on the job, is it masquerades as a kind of knowing. That's the way it whispers to you, right? It says, "Hey, you don't want to do that. You don't want to see that." Mostly, fear is a kind of prophylactic proposition. It's trying to make sure stuff doesn't happen, but none of it is informed by what has happened.
In Grief Walker, you describe seeing in the eyes of the dying an almost toxic fearfulness. Why are they so afraid?
Maybe the question could be better asked, what are they so afraid of? And the case I was trying to make then and now for you is, people go into their dying time pretty certain that their worst torment is going to be physical pain and everything that ensues from that, all the symptomatology and so on. Look, it's understandable. And yeah, it can be very rough. But the truth is, most of the people I worked with had their pain pretty well managed. And they died in a kind of abject, low-grade, and generally undisclosed terror anyway. So it turned out they were wrong about what they were afraid of. And it wasn't the pain after all. I believe that most people die in our culture absolutely riven by the terror that everyone around them is going to be able to proceed in the days, weeks, months, or perhaps years after they die as if they'd never been. And in our culture, we call that getting on with your life. But to a dying person, that is a prescription for oblivion.
Are there other cultures, or do you think earlier in our time, where we didn't have that fear of letting our life go? Like, I think about my grandmother, who died when she was 94, and she lived a really full life. She was a nurse for many, many years, and when she became ill and they offered her hospitalization, declined it, walked upstairs, got in her bed, and 2 weeks later was dead. And she didn't seem afraid, but she was from another time.
Yeah, and perhaps another place in some fashion, too, you know? Well, yeah, there are other places, and some of the places are amongst us, and some of the people who don't respond, as I've described to you, are amongst us, surely. It's the fundamental reason for my work, the belief that something can be done about this. It's not in the cards that we be this way. But it takes a massive courage now to question the wisdom that's handed down to you about the best thing you can do about dying is not to know it's coming. I mean, your grandma knew very well, and she lived her life towards the end of her life as if she knew this. And it turns out, from what you're describing, it wasn't a torment, and it wasn't a ripoff, and it didn't steal from her. What it did was gave her the chance to respond with the kind of living human example that it was bequeathed to you personally. And it said, look, it can also be like this, but you have to decide that. It takes work to do what your grandma did.
I find a lot of comfort in what you're saying, but I also find it frightening.
Yeah, boy.
So how can we meet death without fear?
I'm not sure that you can. I wouldn't even put that as a prerequisite. I would say that the fear, not fearlessness, I don't know that there's such a thing. If you can let fear have its proper proportion, the way you do that is not by requiring yourself to be fearful first, before you make the steps. It'd be something like this. Any courtship vision that you can conjure carries the same understanding. You never felt that it was going to work out as you approached that person. Never did, and it wasn't a prerequisite. If you got desperate enough, maybe you would approach them. Yeah, but you're never fearless about it. And then you discovered that in your cotton mouth and your stumbling feet, somewhere in there, you actually did have the capacity to do this. And everybody's death before yours and mine in our lives is the place where we go to learn this truth, where we learn how to make a place for fear, and also how to make a place for the fact that, you know, life is really habit forming. And who really wants it to end? I mean, you're not supposed to want that, but you're supposed to find a way to dance with it anyhow.
So death is really just what you said when I'm thinking about that. It's very much I don't mean a community experience, but if I look back at the Victorian era, where death was everywhere, and death was in every family all the time, and they had bodies laid out at home, it was much more of a societal, a human experience. It seems we've lost that.
Truly. You asked me earlier what my understanding of the best death would be, and without question, good deaths are village-making events. By definition. And by definition, every bad death is the kind of death that melts or sunders or demeans our capacity to be together. And that's what they ultimately have to be for. They have to draw us together and for a reason that we wish we weren't being drawn together. But ultimately, you know, the wakes, the funerals, the so-called memorial services, and God help us, these so-called celebrations of life, all of them should have the death in them. They almost never do. And until we plow the death back into the field of our life, the fear that you began to ask me about is almost inevitable. Village making is the place where you can, where your sanity can go for a rest. It's not always easy to be sane when you're dying, but when you have people around you who are willing to live as if this is what's happening to you, then in those times when you need the corroboration, you can get it. When you need an amen from somebody around you, it's not an amen that, hey, if we just try everything, you'll never die. The amen you're going to get is, this is your time. You're supposed to be afraid together. And isn't it something to know that? Instead of being held in suspended animation, wondering if it's ever going to happen and hoping it never does. It gives you a chance to do what your grandma did. Would you say, hey, kids, watch this.
Stephen reminds us of what we forget, that death is actually a part of life. If we can embrace death, we're actually embracing life itself. Me? Well, I'm still here, and my obsession with death is perhaps becoming more of an obsession with living. The mantra, you can die at any time, you can die at any time, it still plays in my head, but now more often I hear, live now, you idiot. Live now. Right now. It's hard, though, letting go of that fear and embracing the moment. Embracing the beautiful and terrifying fragility of life. Stephen Jenkinson lives in the Ottawa Valley, and you can find out more about Stephen's work on our Facebook page. Facebook.com/CBC Fear Itself. To get in touch with us, you can email us at fearitself@cbc.ca. Visit our website, cbc.ca/fearitself. where you can find podcasts of the program. Fear Itself is produced by Kent Hoffman, with technical producer Bill Roach. I'm Christiane Conlon. Fear Itself.
This is CBC Radio 1, 91.5 FM in Ottawa. Canada lives here.